then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's August the 15th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, I'm going to open this week with a quick personal comment. Now, this week, I started the process of actually investigating Obamacare in the state of Washington to see if by any wild chance I could actually afford to just buy the bastards off. Now, it's now August 2013, and there is still no concrete information available on Obamacare or how much it's going to cost for real. The Washington State Health Plan Finder website, i.e. the official Obamacare for the state's insurance exchange, according to information I found, will not be up and running until October, at least so they say. The costs are still completely unclear, but judging from one article from Kaiser Permanente I found, someone in my category, which is a 60-year-old white male smoker with pre-existing conditions, will come in at $751 per month, which ain't happening. Oh, and a $3,500 deductible, which basically means the whole thing is pointless anyway. My car insurance is less for a year than that monthly payment. Now, I didn't think I'd be able to afford just to buy the crap and get them off my back, but I had to check it out. Well, now I know. I'd like to ask you guys in the audience a favor. Could you send in your own personal Obamacare experiences and horror stories, preferably on an MP3 file so that you can actually tell your story rather than have me read them out? I'm sure I'm not the only destitute and aging white man or woman in this position. Maybe if we put our heads together, we can figure out some way to stay out of prison. Okay, now let's move on to a few more emails. Now, this one is from Todd in Lincoln, Nebraska. Dear Harold, why are you always saying buggery? That's like saying the N-word and the F-word. It will turn people off and frighten them away from listening to the NF message. Signed, Todd. Okay, this particular question is one I'm not asked too often, but it actually has several ramifications which do crop up in a lot of the things people say to me. First off, there is the implied idea, which is very common in the movement, that we Northwest separatists, or white nationalists in general, have to modify our language and our ideas in order not to, quote-unquote, frighten people away. There are two things wrong with that. Number one is this idea that we all seem to have in the back of our heads, in which we just can't seem to shake, that someday we're going to be some kind of mass movement of millions of white people with nice big crowds that we as individuals can hide in, and it'll actually be somehow respectable or at least a little normal to have a Northwest Front bumper sticker on your car, or at least you can do it without your car being stoned. Nope, not happening. White nationalism of any kind will never, ever be respectable. And we need to deep six that idea right now. There is no point in allowing the media and the racial enemy to set the acceptable parameters of discussion. It won't do us any good to keep within them. We will never, ever get a fair shake from these people. Now, white nationalists and white separatists spend a lot of our time constantly seeking a respectability and an acceptance which this system and this media will never, ever grant to us. They will never stop calling us wicked, evil racists or give us a fair shake until they fear us and fear the consequences of such behavior when it becomes dangerous to be a progressive or a liberal. Now, do you seriously think that the media in Ireland itself ever talked about the Provisional IRA or Gerry Adams like our media treat us? Now, you have to have lived in Ireland like I have back in the days when the Provos were riding high, wide, and handsome, and seen for yourselves the gingerly way in which journalists approached Gerry Adams and Sinn Féin and the pretty much open IRA reps and spokesmen in the 26 counties. Now, believe me, a reporter or a TV interviewer who thinks that you can have his or her kneecaps broken is the most polite and respectful person in the world. Now, these media people build themselves up as big, brave, liberal heroes. Believe me, they ain't. Well, that's Ireland and not here, until such time as we have the balls to make that happen, which doesn't look to be occurring anytime soon. We need to stop worrying about what the media and the establishment think about us. We need to stop crying for the moon. Now, the second thing wrong with that assumption is that we are concerned with recruiting people into some kind of white rotary club. People who are so weak and confused that they can be frightened away by words. Wrong. The Northwest Front will never be a mass movement. We may at some point be able to provide the occasional small crowd for you to hide in, but that won't be for a while. Now, right now, we're looking for a few remaining white people who are not frightened off by words. If a white man or a woman won't stand up and confront and overcome a word, then they're obviously not going to confront and overcome any other problem. Okay, I know I'm rambling again and ignoring Todd's question, so back to buggery. Now, I use that ancient and impressive term instead of homosexuality or gay for several reasons. First off, people who accept the establishment's parameters of discussion are forced into lying. Americans have been so conditioned into accepting this perversion that we often forget, or in many cases we never knew, exactly what it is that homosexuals do. It is indeed a form of mental illness, as Olivia will discuss in a bit. There is not a damned thing gay or lighthearted about homosexuality. It is filthy and sick and unhygienic, and the people who practice it are mentally ill. And this society used to have the moral courage to say so. That is a moral courage that we as a people need to recover. And part of that is to impose our own terminology and parameters of discussion on the debate and not allow the liberals and the media to do it. Secondly, the word buggery is a link with our past. It's an ancient and honorable word, even if it describes a dishonorable act. It is the legal and descriptive term of our ancestors. The first law passed against that particular alternative lifestyle was passed in 1533 during the reign of King Henry VIII, and it was called the Buggery Act. As a typical Harold historical note, in addition to decapitating his wives, Henry was the only English monarch who ever actually had people boiled in oil. Usually that was more common in Spain and Italy. Now, if memory serves, Henry's Buggery Act called for the offending portions of the bugger's anatomy to be cut off and nailed to the local church door. Boy, that must have spiced up the Sunday sermon. Now, look, in its own way, this faggotry business is just as dangerous to the future survival of our people and civilization as Barack Obama and the Democrats, or unlimited third world immigration, or Ben Bernanke's quantitative easing, so forth and so on. We have to get on the right side of it, by which I mean the right side to attract that tiny minority of white men and women who are going to make our revolution and who will bring the Northwest American Republic into being. It's just like race. One of the first things we need to do is seize the parameters of discussion away from the people who want to kill us and never let them get it back. Every time some white man or woman in this country says nigger or beaner or faggot or buggery, even in private, it's a victory for us because it means that, even if it's only for a moment, a white mind has slipped the leash and is not under their control. Now, here's Olivia to talk some more about this progressive perversion of mind and body.
Good afternoon, comrades. Not to get all negative and down in the mouth here, but Harold did touch on this whole pedophilia thing in our panel discussion recently, and I thought his comments were very appropriate and timely. As distasteful as it is, and it's extremely distasteful to say the least, it's something we all need to really think about. Because if this does come to pass, it's going to affect all of us in some pretty profound ways. But honestly, how many of us even gave it another thought after listening to Harold rave for those few minutes, let alone seriously thought in depth about what this is really going to mean not just to our children, but to our people in general and this filthy society as a whole? Pedophilia isn't something anyone actually wants to think about. It's despicable, destructive to children and families involved, and something we all know is just plain wrong. Just like buggery, we don't have to think about it long to know it's sick and cannot be allowed in anything resembling decent society. For most people, treating pedophilia as just another alternative lifestyle similar to being gay is so inconceivable, it honestly never occurs to them that a horror of this magnitude has a snowball's chance in hell of becoming reality. But turn the clock back 50 years and you'd find exactly the same thought process related to buggery. Something that is now a revolting reality in the world we live in today. To quote an article from the Northern Colorado Gazette, dated July 25, 2013, critics of the homosexual lifestyle have long claimed that once it became acceptable to identify homosexuality as simply an alternative lifestyle or sexual orientation, logically nothing would be off limits. Gay advocates have taken offense at such a position, insisting this would never happen. However, psychiatrists are now beginning to advocate redefining pedophilia in the same way homosexuality was redefined several years ago. In 1973, the American Psychiatric Association declassified homosexuality from its list of mental disorders. A group of psychiatrists with Before You Act recently held a symposium proposing a new definition of pedophilia in the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual of Mental Health Disorders of the APA. Before You Act calls pedophiles minor attracted people. The organization's website states its purpose is to, quote, help mental health professionals learn more about attraction to minors and to consider the effect of stereotyping, stigma, and fear, unquote. This change in the laws has been in the works for a very long time. Quoting the same article, in 1998, the APA issued a report claiming that the, quote, negative potential, unquote, of adult sex with children was, quote, overstated, unquote, and that the vast majority of both men and women reported no negative sexual effects from childhood sexual abuse experiences. Do the math. This was 15 years ago. I don't know if you've ever encountered someone who was forced to face sexuality before they were emotionally, mentally, and physically mature enough to even be interested, let alone understand what sexual intimacy means, but I have, and I can honestly say that the negative impacts are actually vastly understated rather than overstated, as the APA claims. Even an idiot could figure that out by imagining themselves in a situation like that as a 5, 6, 8, or 10-year-old. It doesn't take much imagination to get a sense of how icky and degrading and destructive it would be, and how profoundly it would affect all other interactions. Many of you have young sons and daughters who are healthy, mentally, spiritually, and physically, given the world we live in. I don't think any of you even want to imagine, never mind experience, the horror and devastation this would bring about in your lives should this become a reality. And make no mistake, given the history of the gay movement and the recognition and status its proponents now receive in this country, there's very little to stop pedophilia from gaining a foothold now that the floodgates have been opened with buggery. There is a way to make sure it never happens to your children, however. Come home. Help us make the Northwest American Republic a reality sooner rather than later. Build the future you want for your children rather than the one that's being dumped on them as we speak. There are choices, but you have to make them for yourselves. No one can make them for you. Hail victory, comrades.
Now to cleanse our mouth and our minds of all that filth, here's Mike Cross.
Bo Weevil said to the farmer, "You better treat me right. I'll eat up all your cotton, sleep in your grain ridge tonight." And don't you think of buying no farm machine. I'll eat up all your cotton, ain't buy no gasoline. See that little spider climbing up and down the wall? I believe he's gonna get his ashes home. I don't see no water, but I'm about to drown. But I'm burning down. Bo Weevil said to the farmer, "You better treat me right. I'll eat up all your cotton, sleep in your grain ridge tonight." Thank you.
evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to discuss the 13th tribe. And this is a story, of course, about the Khazars and how they came to embrace Judaism. Now, the story starts out that in 740, Leo the Khazar decides to embrace Judaism. The Khazars originally were a Turkish group, and they spoke the Chavas dialect. And they were a very powerful tribe out on the steppe, and they were fanatical anti-Muslim fighters. Now, the story of how they embraced Judaism, one story is that they looked at Islam and Christianity, and they found that Judaism was in common for all three, and so they decided to become Jewish. And there's a story of a King Balgan who was visited by an angel and was told to build a temple. And so he raided Armenia for gold and silver. And there's a very important letter that King Joseph wrote to Hadassah, which was a Western European Jew, about the conversion of King Balgan. And that's a very important document that really explains the Khazar conversion. Now, many of the Khazars were practicing something called Karaite Judaism, which was a very primitive form of Judaism. And the agents of the Khazars actually appointed a puppet Magyar king at one point by the name of Arpad. The Magyars actually learned a lot of their raiding techniques from the Khazars. There's always this sort of love-hate affair between the Khazars and other groups, and there's a lot of various things that go on, but at one point, there's somebody that pronounces himself the Messiah and takes the name of David L. Roy and uses the Star of David as his symbol. So that's one story of how that symbol came about. In the year 1222, there's something called the Golden Bull, which was a series of laws limiting the Khazar powers. But even then, there was a court that hangs on for 11 years. Now, a legend has it that Poland was actually ruled by a Khazar by the name of Abraham Provonik, who resigned in favor of the Pious Dynasty, which actually lasted from 962 to 1370. King Borislav was very generous to the Khazars, and so much so that Pope Clement noted that many synagogues were actually grander than churches. Now, the 14th century was a difficult time for the Jews, and that was a time when they got together in chattels. They dominated the timber industry, and they also developed a type of horse cart that was very important until the railways came. As various Jews, Western and Eastern European, were expelled from various parts of Europe, they tended to pour into Italy, Poland, and Hungary. It appears that Yiddish is really an Eastern European Jewish or a Khazar dialect. And the writer says this because a lot of the words in Yiddish are actually East German, which would suggest east to west migration for the Khazars and for most of the Jews that were coming into Germany and Poland around that time. And this was so because as Poland developed, Poles encouraged a lot of German immigrants to come into Poland. And so anyone in Poland had to know at least some German. Now, another claim for the development of Yiddish was that there were Khazars living in the Crimea, where there were Goths, and so they developed a Creole language there. And I think that's also a very strong possibility. Now, the Renaissance was a very difficult time for Jews, and this was when they had a lot of living in ghettos. Now, the author talks about the ghettos and says that there was a lot of interbreeding or inbreeding in the ghettos, but he also says there was a lot of intermarriage before and that. For example, in 1921, out of 100 marriages involving Jews, 42 were mixed. So the author says it's very hard to recognize whether or not someone is Jewish. However, he does talk about the famous Ashkenazi Jewish nose, which he says is not present among Bedouins. Now, he says that in his opinion, he believes that Israel is a valid nation, and he thinks the Jews should migrate to Israel. However, if they do not want to go to Israel, he feels that they should assimilate. Personally, I think that's a bad idea because, specifically, the Ashkenazi, which the author admits many Jews are, have many very serious genetic illnesses. So I found this an interesting book, and I've been told to keep this review rather brief. So I hope you enjoyed the review, and thank you for listening.
As I've mentioned several times over the past weeks, in my opinion, one of my tasks on this show is to educate white nationalists, especially young people who haven't had the same opportunity I had in my younger days to read all the racial classics, as to our movement's history, in essence to show white people where we came from, and yes, there is a great deal to our history other than the Klan and Commander Rockwell. I've already mentioned our populist past, and Gretchen did a review of a biography I sent her of the famous Georgia populist Tom Watson. But another name, a very famous name that we all need to know, is that of William Jennings Bryan from Nebraska. The Cross of Gold speech was delivered by William Jennings Bryan at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago on July the 9th, 1896. Yes, believe it or not, there was a time when the Democrats were the good guys. Now, in this address, Bryan supported bimetallism, or free silver. He decried the gold standard, concluding the speech with, "You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." Bryan's address helped catapult him to the Democratic Party's presidential nomination, and it's considered one of the greatest political speeches in American history. Now, the gold standard, which the United States had effectively been on since 1873, once the last of Lincoln's greenbacks were tossed, limited the money supply, but it eased trade with other nations like the United Kingdom, whose currency was also based on gold. However, many Americans believed that making both gold and silver legal tender was necessary to free up the money supply and make things better for the lower elements of society. Now, long story short, the rich bankers and the Jews like J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller and Rothschild wanted to stay on the gold-only standard, and the poor people, the farmers, and the middle class wanted to use silver coins. Now, the financial panic of 1893 really stirred things up. It was the major depression of the 19th century, and when Grover Cleveland continued to support the gold standard against the will of the people, the Populist Party determined to take over the Democratic Party organization and nominate a silver-supporting candidate in 1896. This is the kind of thing that sometimes we're urged to do, take over the Republicans. Now, Bryan had been a dark horse candidate with very little support in the convention, but his speech electrified the whole convention, and it's generally credited with getting him the nomination for president. However, he lost the general election to William McKinley, who was later plugged by a Polish anarchist, and the United States formally adopted the gold standard in 1900. Now, there were no recording devices in 1896, at least none that could be effectively used in such a setting as a big convention hall. But this speech was so famous and popular that Bryan always had to deliver it again and again any time he held a meeting or attended a party. It was kind of his party piece. So, as you can imagine, he pretty much had it off by memory. Now, I don't know when this recording was made, but this is William Jennings Bryan delivering his famous Cross of Gold speech, one of the first major attacks on Jewish money power in American history. Now, bear in mind, when he's making this recording, he is a very old man, and you need to envision him in a sweltering hot convention hall in Chicago, bellowing this out at the top of his lungs without the benefit of an electronic microphone or speaker or anything like that, so that the entire convention can hear him. And I think you can see how powerful it might have been under those circumstances, but give it a listen.
Mr. Chairman and gentlemen of the convention, I would be presumptuous indeed to present myself against the distinguished gentleman to whom you have listened, if this were a mere measuring of abilities. But this is not a contest between persons. The humblest citizen in all the land, when clad in the arm of a righteous cause, is stronger than all the hosts of error. I come to speak to you in defense of a cause as holy as the cause of liberty, the cause of humanity. Mr. Carlyle said in 1878 that this was a struggle between the idle holders of idle capital and the struggling masses who produce the wealth and pay the taxes of the country. They tell us that the great cities are in favor of the gold standard. We reply that the great cities rest upon our broad and fertile prairies. Burn down your cities and leave our farms, and your cities will spring up again as if by magic. But destroy our farms, and the grass will grow in the streets of every city of the country. We care not upon what line the battle is fought, if they say bimetallism is good, but that we cannot have it until other nations help us. We reply that instead of having a gold standard, because England has, we will restore bimetallism, and then let England have bimetallism, because the United States has. If they dare to come out in the open field and defend the gold standard as a good thing, we will fight them to the uttermost. Having behind us the producing masses of this nation and the world, supported by the commercial interests, the laboring interests, and the toilers everywhere, we will answer their demand for a gold standard by saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold.
And speaking of where we come from, here is the tag end of last week's interview with my old friend and comrade, Pastor Bob Miles.
It makes money, but not for them, but for the state, for those who worship Satan. If they want to serve their God and serve their race, they'll stay out of all those wars. Nothing is ever resolved in war. Nothing but profit.
I know you've written that most of the wars that we've been involved in have been fratricidal wars.
And civil wars, apparently.
Simply Caucasians killing Caucasians, and then many of the wars where we've been involved in third world nations have been economically, almost totally economically inspired.
Vietnam was a very successful war, not for the people. Yeah. Very successful for those who manufacture the guns, make the uniforms, profit off all the different programs that it produces. The bureaucrat delights in war. And bureaucracy and Bolshevism are the same thing.
Why do people fall for the con? I mean, that's a hard question, I know. Why do they continually march out into these fiascos when there's ample evidence available to people to show them the fallacy of it? How are they able to mesmerize people?
That's a good question.
You know, well, how do they feel, all right, for it? Because inside each person is a desire to be liked, even to the extent that they will kill somebody else in order to be liked back home. There's a desire to be part of the mass. Most people like to be sheep. They don't want to be shepherds. They don't want to be wolves. They like to be with that mass of sheep that procreate, romp in the grass. They want to be one of the crowd. And going to war, becoming a soldier, and I've fought in three wars. I fought for this country, and I fought for the free French. There's a sense of belonging. There's a sense of having done something special. Once they understand that the price they pay for that is too high for their soul, that will be the day that the chiefs and the presidents and dictators and kings will have to go back to doing the warring themselves.
Do you think that we're looking towards an era of sedition, trials, and arrests in the future again?
Definitely.
Like we had during the 30s?
Definitely. You're entering a period of time now where your liberties, your ability to be heard, despite this program and similar programs like it around the country, will be highly limited. The nature of bureaucracy, the nature of government is such that it has to suppress dissent. It cannot permit it to thrive, and you're in a period of time when it will be thriving like flowers.
Well, it's quite clear that you oppose the civil-type war among the racial elements of the whites, and you also oppose the economic wars that are guised as various names that they go under. But I know you're not a pacifist from what I've read from your material.
No.
I haven't met any of your people who've been pacifists. So
you must believe in self-defense or racial
That's not
self-defense.
A war. We're talking about the difference. If you come to my house and tell me you're going to take something that belongs to me, I am going to resist you.
Right.
I'll resist you whether you're an individual a government or a mob. But when you're talking about organized killing, slaughter mm-hmm. of people so that others may profit from it, like this Israeli adventure that we're involved in, where the land's been taken away from the Arab people, we support a military garrison state there, mm-hmm. we've had 200 and some of our own youth killed for absolutely nothing. When you tell me that I have to support that, I tell you that's contrary to the laws that I was given that are above all laws of this country, and those are the laws of God. That I obey first. Then if there's something left over, I'll give it to the state, but there'll be damn little left over.
Well, I was wondering, I was reading some references in the Old Testament one time. I found over 100 references that, of course, the further back you go, the less clear they are, but there are really over 100 references, that most of which only implied the implications against race mixing. But yet I found in Ezra chapter 9, for instance, I mean, it was very clear that the intention of the ancient laws of, say, the Hebrews or Israelites at that time was that there be no intermarriage between that tribe and, say, the other tribes that they were associating with, even though that they were to do good works for the other tribe. They were not to intermarry, but displeased God that they did. Now, is this still true in the dualist philosophy, does the dualist philosophy take from that?
Well,
do you believe that race mixing is okay?
No, because our position on intermarriage between the races is very simple. The races were originally established for a reason by God. We may not understand those reasons, but they exist. Mm-hmm. Each race had powers, had special characteristics that the other races didn't have. It's not like saying, well, the white race is superior, or the black race is superior, or the yellow race is superior. Mm-hmm. We don't. But we say that each had special characteristics. And the only way we'll regain those powers and those characteristics is by the cleaning up of our own genetic pools. We're not saying we're at the finish line of the race, as some people mistakenly say. We say we're at the beginning of it. Mm-hmm. That for the black, the return to his purity is going to bring him strengths and powers that he's mm-hmm. lost. That for the yellow, it's the same thing, or the white, the same thing. So that we say that as we breed our animals very carefully to bring out the best characteristics, we have to do the same thing with our own families. If you're interested in saving the whales from extinction, why in the world wouldn't you be interested in saving each of the races from extinction?
How, from your perspective, do you have a chance against the tremendous propaganda machinery that has convinced people of an equalitarian, the equality myth, and that miscegenation is wonderful and it's going to lead us in some kind of arena? How can you fight that from your perspective?
Without any doubt, unnatural things collapse by their very nature. The very fact that out of 500,000 marriages or more a year, less than 50,000 involve people of different races, despite all the effort of the churches, the schools, the big corporations, and the state, all that massive weight that's been brought to bear, and yet you only have 50,000 marriage out of this group. I have total confidence that a black man chooses a black woman because they have the shared experiences of growing up together. They have the desires, they have the likes and dislikes that are common to each. The same way with an Irish or a German person lived in a German community. Breaking down those communities doesn't destroy that characteristic. It still lives.
So when they say that Pastor Robert Miles is a racist...
Pure and simple, and I bow and I admit it, I love it.
But he is not a hater.
Oh, no. There's a difference.
Yes.
If I were black, I would be like Farrakhan. I would be true to my faith and true to my people. I am white. I am true to my race, to my family, to my faith.
Pastor Miles, we're running out of time.
Okay, one quick question. Do you believe that the media portrayal of interracial couples encourages race mixing or has a negative
quick
effect?
Quick one here.
Quick.
It has more of a negative effect than a positive effect.
I see.
We want to thank the audience for being with us today with Pastor Robert Miles and David Wiley, my co-host, and you'll see our address at the end of the show and the address of our guest. If you'd like to communicate with either of us, we would be happy to hear from you. Until next time, I'm Tom Metzger, and thank you.
Here's another song from Arlen Brand in the UK. This is called Eye of Votan. I'm not quite sure whether you'd call this rock or folk or what, but give it a listen and see what you think.
elusive creature, purveyor of lies, corrupting and defiling, evil in your eyes, repulsive creature, purveyor of lies, corrupting and defiling, evil in your eyes, evil in your eyes, evil in your eyes, evil in your eyes. Inversion of truth, a twisted lie, perversion of reality, the white man dies. Inversion of truth, a twisted lie, perversion of reality, the white man dies, the white man dies, the white man dies, the white man dies. I have walked and will see through you. I have walked and sees through the deceivers. I have walked and sees through the deceivers. I have walked and sees through the deceivers. I have walked and nurturing fictions and victim cries, distraction by trivia. Destroy ancestral ties, ancestral ties, ancestral ties, ancestral ties.
I'm going to respond to an email of a kind that I get in many different forms and that I've been getting for a long time now from multiple people, but much more so since the revelations of Edward Snowden, and that's on the topic of computer encryption. Now, at least once a week, I get an email from someone, which is kind of in two parts. Now, the first part is, yeah, they're watching us, Harold. They're everywhere. They're watching every keystroke we make. They're spying on us through our own webcams. They've got spy cameras and facial recognition software watching everybody who goes in and out of Radio Shack. And they've got these tiny little microphones in the sugar bowls in every restaurant. Yeah! You get the idea. You've probably gotten some emails like this yourselves. And the horrible thing is that if we can believe Edward Snowden, and I think the dictatorship's reaction to his revelations, if nothing else, demonstrates that we can, then yeah, these people are right. The secret police probably are watching every keystroke we make, and they probably do have fiber optic listening devices in all the sugar bowls. Now, I know for a fact that they're watching me, because it's official in my case. I'm on the terrorist watch list. And so are you, if you've ever emailed me, or if you listen to Radio Free Northwest. It's all there in the metadata that the FBI and the DHS and NSA have been collecting all these years, long before Edward Snowden blew the whistle. You guys out there do know that, right? I remember a cartoon I saw recently. It was at a psychiatrist's convention, and the speaker with glasses and a goatee was up on the podium speaking to the assembled shrinks, and he was saying, "Colleagues, in the light of Edward Snowden's information, it strikes me that for many years now we've been treating perfectly sane and normal people for paranoia." Yes, we've all been paranoid for many years now, and now we know why. They really are out to get us. It's called a surveillance state. The ultimate goal of a surveillance state is for the secret police to watch and listen to everybody all the time. Like George Orwell described in his novel 1984. Up until recently, that hasn't been technically feasible, although some left-wing regimes had secret police like the Romanian Securitate and the East German Stasi who came pretty close. In the days when electronic eavesdropping equipment was primitive and cumbersome, the Stasi were big on human informers. That's estimated that at one time over one-third of the population of East Germany worked for the state security as informers. The Stasi had an informer on every block and on every factory line and in every pub. Okay, the second thing in these emails that I get from people usually involves some kind of computer encryption, which I have to drop everything and immediately teach myself and install on my computer so we can all hide from Obama, as if that were possible. Now, every week it seems that there's a new buzz on the internet. Encrypt your hard drive and encrypt your email with so-and-so, and the FBI and the NSA spies can't break it. Oh, yeah. Now, this week, the big encryption fad is something called TrueCrypt. The consensus of opinion seems to be that it's pretty good. Now, at the risk of upping the paranoia level even further, I'm going to state right up front that I do not believe there is such a thing as a commercially available computer encryption package that normal people can get hold of, which cannot be broken by the security organs and the ex-hackers that they hire under threat of a long prison sentence to do their cyber dirty work for them. Now, I know that having said that, I am going to get about 50 emails from our Wired audience vowing and swearing that I'm wrong and I have my head up my ass because such and such an encryption program is absolutely, utterly unbreakable, for sure, for sure. Okay, fine. We'll just take all that as read. I still don't believe it. Because given the level of genuine paranoia, as in delusional insanity, which is now gripping our lords and masters, any encryption program that they couldn't access simply wouldn't be allowed. If it was American, they'd either demand that the manufacturers put a back door in the program for them, or they'd classify the patent. And if it was foreign, they would use their assorted long arms to suppress whoever was doing it. And if you don't believe they can do that, ask Julian Assange why he's sitting in two little rooms in the Ecuadorian embassy in London right now. Okay, fine. Look, if you guys want to encrypt all your computer stuff out the wazoo so the FBI won't be able to read our emails that we send among ourselves in our pitifully small little circle, bitching and moaning about Obama and niggers in general, at least until such time as their own computer geeks can come up with a way to break that particular encryption, okay, fine, do it. Encrypt away. Knock yourselves out. But I'm not going to drop everything and start filling up my computer with all kinds of new software that I have to stop and teach myself how to use, and then try to get all the rest of you guys to use it, just so I can encrypt my Northwest Revolution emails reporting on nigger flash mobs in Jacksonville, Florida. As to my hard drive, if we can believe Snowden, which I think we can, the secret police are already there. And if not, they can be there remotely or else simply kick in my door anytime they want, with or without a warrant, as the spirit might move them, and take the damn thing. And if they do, the FBI will learn absolutely nothing about me that they cannot learn from reading my novels or listening to this program. That is my own defense against the dictatorship's growing surveillance state. My life is an open book. I am a political dissident. I make no secret of that. There is no mystery as to what I believe or what I think, and I say so openly and without fear. Yes, I can afford to do that because I have no family and I have no job to protect and I have no stake in this society. I know that doesn't apply to most of you guys. And yes, I know this attitude of mine will probably get me killed one day. I understand that and I accept it. That doesn't mean I want to hasten the day when I hear my door splintering off the hinges and hear the screaming castrati in their black body armor. And that gets into another reason that I don't use encryption. Now, I get accused all the time of baiting and taunting the secret police like I have a death wish, like I want to be arrested. And they're right. This is actually my plan to get around the Obamacare law and get free health care in my old age paid for by the government. And I can never forget that the government saved Pastor Butler's life in prison when they paid for a triple heart bypass that he could never have afforded on his own on the outside, so that they could try him for treason at Fort Smith in 1988. And then the damn jury went and acquitted him. Okay, seriously. I'm not kidding about them watching me. They really are. I won't get into how I know, but yes, my occasional cracks about FBI agents and U.S. attorneys sitting in cubicles with their heads down to the speakers and their hands cupped around their ears, parsing every sentence I say, is actually not too far wrong. I'm on the terrorist watch list, but my guess is that right now I'm about 1,937th on their to-do list. However, if I were suddenly to start sending out encrypted messages that they really couldn't read, that would trigger this regime's extreme paranoia, I mean as in clinical insanity, rubber room type stuff. And they would be all over me like a cheap suit. Now right now they seem to be watching me and harassing people on the periphery of the NF, like that guy in Texas whose yard they spent 2 days digging up, and the guy back east whose computer they forced their way into by claiming they were looking for kiddie porn, and the guy up here in Northwest that they keep sleazing around trying to make him turn informer, so forth and so on. Most of those strike me basically as budget burners. See, what you've got to bear in mind, folks, I've said this before, I'll say it again because it's important you understand this. Without terrorists, there can't be anti-terrorists. Anti-terrorism has become a huge industry in this country since 9/11. There are billions and billions of federal taxpayer dollars being appropriated in order to, quote-unquote, fight terrorism. All these agencies want the biggest possible cut of the pie as they can get hold of, but the trouble is there's a shortage of actual for real terrorists, and so basically the agencies have to make them up. And once they get that budget, they have to burn the budget, they have to spend it in ways that are allegedly tracking down terrorists, so this is how they get to spend 2 days digging up some guy's yard in Texas, whose name they got off Facebook, and who I suspect they knew perfectly well wasn't committing any crimes. Unless you count being Facebook friends with me to be a crime. Okay, I'm wandering off again. Anyway, the thing is, our friends in the silk suits know that there's nothing to inform on as far as I'm concerned. The Bureau already had one guy in here with a wire as early as 3 years ago, and they didn't find anything. Now, people ask me why I'm not in jail for having written and said the things I have. Well, part of the reason, if not the whole reason, is that I don't actually break any laws, and they know it. Now, that certainly helps. It's not conclusive. I mean, Edgar Steele didn't break any laws either, and look where he is. Bill White never actually did anything illegal, and look where he is. The droids have been on me off and on for my whole life, and intensively since 2000, when I published Slow Coming Dark and pissed off Hillary Clinton. Apparently, that's when my Secret Service file was revived again after my Waco contretemps, which we won't get into. Anyway, suffice it to say that if any of the agencies could have caught me so much as jaywalking or spitting on the sidewalk, I'd be in prison right now. Their best bet is still to wait about a year and then arrest me for the crime of not having any money, when I can't pay my Obamacare fine to the IRS, and that may be what they're doing. But imagine what would happen if I started sending out messages that really were encrypted in some manner that these paranoid secret policemen really couldn't read. Or if I was able to find some way to effectively shield my computer from their spy software so that they couldn't monitor every keystroke I made and add it to their metadata collection. You have to bear in mind one thing about these FBI agents and DHS bureaucrats and U.S. attorneys and federal judges. The white agents, and officials at least, are not totally stupid. They see what's happening around them and they can project what it all means, and at least some of them do have the good sense to be afraid. Now, they'll never admit it, of course, because to admit that they are terrified would violate their precious self-image of themselves as superior to everybody else. And that is essential to the liberal mind, but make no mistake, they are terrified. They can see that their world is crumbling around them. Now, these people who work every day in government and the law know better than any of us what kind of mentally and emotionally unstable people, what stunning fools and incompetents our lords and masters really are. They know that the people running this society can't take it. They can't cut the mustard. They're just not good enough to weather the next 20 years or so and keep the ship afloat. They know that the present power structure cannot measure up intellectually or morally to the storm that they can see coming far more clearly than any of us. And I repeat, at least some of these white FBI and other secret police agents, some of these U.S. attorneys, some of these bureaucrats are terrified, because they are way higher up on the shit heap than us, and that means that they can see what's rolling towards this country across the plain much better than we can. They're trying to prepare for it by militarizing local police and loading them up with full auto weapons and black body armor and putting drones in the sky and spy cameras on every corner and microchips tracking people's cars and phones, and none of it's doing a damn bit of good. The ball of wax is still falling to pieces. Tell you what, let's do our third music break, and I'll tell you a little story. Now, this is for all our tired and overworked federal employees who are listening to this podcast out of their deep love of country and their impassioned duty to protect mom, God, and apple pie from the forces of darkness, like me. This is Little Big Town.
You made that bed. they're gonna come out. They're waiting for the sun to go down. You can't hide from your demons. You feel them all lurking around. You're running scared cause you know they're out there. They're waiting for the sun to go down.
Okay, we've actually got a little time at the end of third music break this week, so before I get into the little story I wanted to tell you, I have time for this one last email from Arthur in Salt Lake City, who apparently has a problem with Mormons. Dear HAC, I want to ask you, is the Northwest Front a white movement or a Christian white movement? I'm not religious, and I wonder if I will be treated badly because of that fact. In a nutshell, I want to know if it's going to be some kind of Utah Mormon 1984 hellscape. Basically, I'm white, non-gay, non-Jew, and non-religious. Is the Northwest the place for me? Signed, Arthur. Yes, Arthur, it is the place for you. Actually, there are some people who do worry about this. Now, we have a violently anti-Christian element within the white nationalist movement, as I'm sure most of you will be aware, and these people either genuinely believe, or they pretend to believe for goat dancing purposes, that I'm some kind of Christian cult leader like David Koresh, and the Northwest Republic will be some kind of theocracy with me as God. Nope. Then there are the genuine Christian fanatics who want the Republic to become a kind of high-tech Puritan New England, complete with scarlet letters and witch burnings. Now, I'm afraid all I'm able to offer you guys is faggot burnings, and that's going to have to do you. Okay, look, let me lay this out again. Northwest nationalism is a movement of blood, not faith. We have no religious axe to grind except where religion is used as a cloak for so-called progressive politics, things like Christian Zionism, so forth and so on. Christian Zionism isn't a religion, it's a political ideology. Arthur and anyone else who's worried about that needs to go to the website and check out the 2006 draft of the Northwest American Republic's Constitution, if you don't believe me. Or read a certain section toward the end of my novel, A Mighty Fortress, wherein I discuss religion as a movement issue. Okay, now for the little story I wanted to tell you. It's one of my typical Haroldian historical anecdotes. All you FBI agents and U.S. attorneys who are listening in, pay attention. You guys might learn something, too. In East Germany, the Ministerium für Staatssicherheit, otherwise known as the Stasi, was the official state security service of the GDR for 40 years, from 1950 to 1990, when the whole country simply imploded, quite literally overnight. It has been described as one of the most effective and repressive intelligence and secret police agencies in the world. Although the Stasi had a number of German directors down through the years, the real power behind the throne, so to speak, was always a Jew named Marcus Wolf, who became head of the foreign section in 1957. Now, earlier in this podcast, I mentioned that all of the left-wing regimes who have attempted to build a total surveillance state, and it's only left-wing regimes that attempt to do this, the Stasi came the closest to achieving the ultimate goal of watching everybody all the time. When the GDR collapsed and their records were opened, over 2 million people were identified as active Stasi informers, and I repeat that it is estimated that 1 out of every 3 East Germans were informers for the Stasi at some time in their lives. Never before in history has surveillance in any society been so total. The army of informers didn't just report allegedly criminal or suspicious activities to their Stasi handlers. They were placed so that they could watch homes, apartment buildings, factories and workplaces, parks and circuses and theaters, anywhere people gathered. And they would file reports simply stating facts. What time someone went to work, what time they came home, what they had for lunch, the clothes they were wearing, what records they listened to or TV programs they watched, if any, what they bought at the store, any snippets of overheard conversation, so forth and so on. Nor were human informers their only resource. The Stasi routinely got a copy of all telegrams and tapped all telephone lines in East Germany, period. And toward the end of their existence, they were recording some huge percentage of calls, possibly even all of them. They had a staff of over 92,000 agents and clerks and analysts and whatnot, which I think is even larger than the FBI in a country one-tenth the size of this one. Stasi agents routinely did break-ins in people's homes and apartments when they were absent, not so much to look for evidence of a specific crime, but just for information-gathering purposes. Stasi agents would rummage through drawers, write down all the books on somebody's bookshelf. They'd go through your closets looking for clothes or shoes or anything of foreign manufacture, which of course meant that someone was a spy. The Stasi maintained a file on every East German citizen beginning at birth. Now, is any of this starting to sound familiar? Add high tech and you've got the modern FBI and NSA of Edward Snowden. Now, the point that I'm trying to make here is that this massive surveillance state that we're worried about has been tried before. Not with modern technology, true, but the Stasi did their best to completely clamp down on society through total monitoring and total knowledge. The complete elimination of privacy, just like our friends in the silk suits are trying to do to us today. And they failed. Yes, they failed. On October the 4th, 1990, East Germany fell. I say again, it was almost literally overnight, and some of you are old enough to remember when this happened, and we were all stunned. I have to admit, the one thing I never thought I'd ever live to see was the Iron Curtain go down. Now, East Germany fell for the same reason that the United States of America will fall, because its leaders were criminal and stupid people who became too arrogant and incompetent to hang on to their power. I won't go into a long digression as to why, except to say that their underlying system, communism, didn't work, just like Obama's Marxism light won't work in this country. And no amount of human effort could change the fact that these things don't work. Just like the United States no longer works, and it hasn't really worked for some time. All that effort, 40 years of it, by all those secret policemen and their dictatorship still collapsed. Just like Obama and the Democrats will collapse one day. Hey, FBI, you remember those scenes on CNN with the mobs of young Germans storming the Stasi offices in places like East Berlin and Leipzig and so on? When the Stasi agents threw down their guns and ran, just like you will someday? because they knew that they were beaten and their day was over, just like you'll know when your time comes. Now, you remember all those young people throwing those secret files out of the second and third story windows with all the papers coming out and raining down into the street or onto the square like it was snowing? We're going to do that to you one day. Or somebody will. One day, people are going to look up at the J. Edgar Building in D.C. and Quantico and 100 federal buildings all across this country, and they're going to see masses of people throwing your shit out the windows. All of your files and your precious papers and your computers and your hard drives that you have used to spy on us and monitor us and harass us and in some cases to murder us. And maybe they'll throw the chairs and the fixtures from your cubicles out after them just to make a clean sweep of it. It's going to happen. And I think deep down, most of you guys know it. But our time is up now, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha on the Bon. Freedom.
Still is beating heart.